Nick, give us a couple of examples, if you can, of people that you've talked to who have or claim to have been mind controlled.
Well, you know, most of them actually describe very similar symptoms. And what's difficult is to sort it out because there's so many different ways to carry a signal in. But generally speaking, you know, voices are often auditory. Information is usually one of the things that you most commonly hear about. Now, there's been a lot of speculation in this area, and of course it's sometimes difficult to make determinations on, you know, who's really a victim and who isn't. And I don't make that distinction. I mean, my sense of it is whatever's going on with each of these individuals is unique. There are some very specific patterns that start to emerge. What's happened, though, more recently is because of the advent of the Internet, you don't know whether people are just mimicking other people's symptoms. But I have records that go back before the Internet was the way people communicated. I have boxes of files from individuals that have been sent to me over the years. And when you read their reports, the symptoms almost always read the same. And so I think there's some real credibility there. When you look at the New York Times as an example, they actually said that the Unabomber, who everybody's heard about by now, was an MK-Ultra victim. Now, the question becomes, in my mind, was he a Unabomber because he was an MK-Ultra victim? Is that why he felt that academics had betrayed him? Is that why he did the things that he did? You know, he was not alone in that. The government admitted 8,000 military service personnel involved in these experiments. You see this, the CIA settling with Canadian citizens who've been victimized by this. I think there's a lot of credibility there. And what I've said to victims over the years is let's not put the cart before the horse. Let's try and educate the public on the technologies as a priority. And once the public knows about the technologies, then there's the question that everyone can ask and get an answer to is, who were the experimental subjects and what has happened to them in the intervening years and what can we do to attempt to make them whole? And that can't happen until there's more disclosure. And the Washington Post taking the issue on, Sonoma State University taking this issue on, and other organizations taking it on, I think will do exactly that. The Lay Institute on Technology, where I serve as exec director, is actually configuring a closed meeting of it looks like we're going to have 10 to 12 of the top scientists in the world brought together on this issue. It'll be the first time that they've been brought together in a non-governmental environment to talk about mind control technologies. Now, that's going to happen sometime in March. In fact, there are some of the things right after that that we're going to be able to report out. It's going to be an organized effort to really look at how do we get the public on board, how do we show the public what is happening in this area in a more cohesive way with that type of scientific backing beyond what's already in the open literature. So I think the steps that are being taken in consideration of the fact that, yes, there are victims to this technology. Who are they and where are they is something that I think the American public is entitled to know, and these people are entitled to fair compensation, and more importantly, whoever's responsible for these abuses needs to be held to account in front of courts of their peers.
Well, I agree with all that. Who came up with all this, Nick? Somebody concocted it.
In the very beginning, well, if you go back to the beginning of mind control-related research, you've got to go back to, you go back all the way to hypnosis. I mean, in the 1880s, when they were really starting to get excited about the possibilities of hypnosis, it started to emerge as a pretty interesting science. By the 20s, at Harvard University, they had a lab where they were working on hypnosis as a major method, and they found that one out of five people could be taken into such a deep state of hypnosis that they could split the personality. And they had a guy named George Estabrooks working at Harvard discovered that he could create what he said was the super spy. He wrote three very important books, one of them from 1943 called Hypnotism, which is a classic. It was revised in 1957. Another one called Spiritism, which is about transmediums that he believed were, in fact, reflections of split personalities or something of a similar nature. The last book he wrote that was the most important from my perspective written in 1961 was one called The Future of the Human Mind, where he talked about LSD as a therapeutic technique, about creating a split personality, or what we would call today a Manchurian candidate. And the way he described this was that the personalities would be fractured into two components, where one personality would have absolutely no knowledge of the other personality would have full knowledge of both. And they felt that you could send this dead mind personality into a place like the Soviet Union in those days, could function as a spy, and if ever captured, wouldn't have a clue, would also be missing a whole lot of life in terms of being able to describe their history. But it took 10 months to condition the super spy. And when you, if you talk to anyone involved in psychology, splitting personalities is like Humpty Dumpty. You cannot put these people back together again. And this is the nature of that research. By 1935, Estabrook's research in this area was classified, and it continued into the 1950s, into the 1960s, and on. And when you look at what has made it out into the public domain, it's a grain of sand on the beach, I'm sure, in terms of information that's out there. What we've done is collect a huge amount of data in one place, distill it down, and try and get it out to the public. The effort that we're putting into this is going to be the same kind of effort that we put into the disclosure on HARP, which we continue to report on. Interestingly enough, the public relations guy who responded to the Washington Post article this weekend, Rich Garcia, happens to be the same public relations guy that's been dealing with HARP for the last 7 or 8 years.
Massive amounts of control, then. What are they paranoid about, Nick?
The truth. I think it scares the heck out of them that when the American public is fully awakened to what has happened within our own country and what continues to happen, that none of us, liberal or conservative, will stand for it. You know, if you go back to Zbigniew Brzezinski's work, and he wrote a book called Between Two Ages, and it was a book in 1973 before he was National Security Advisor to Carter. But what he was saying then was that the technology would emerge that would allow for the manipulation of human beings in just the way we're describing today. And what he said is no matter who was in charge, liberal or conservative, the temptation to use it to further their own political ends would be greater than their good sense to refrain. And if you look at sort of this arrogant attitude of our national leaders today, in their view of that they are all-powerful, all-deciding, in this paternalistic view of the rest of us, this is where the problem resides.